their time to present their music to you. It's a wonderful venture. It's a wonderful grassroots effort. So if you'd like to check out what we're all about, just go to our website, woodsongs.com, and send me an email while you're there. My email address is michael@woodsongs.com.
Hey, you're tuned to CILU 102.7 FM. Here's what's up in Thunder Bay for Monday, March the 2nd. Foundry has comedy open mic. It's 19+. There's no cover. Starts at 8:30 and it's followed by karaoke with Citywide Sound. Looking ahead to Tuesday, Cheers the Village Pub has open mic night featuring Chris Tonkins. Goes from 8 until 11, all ages, no cover. And on Tuesday as well, Foundry has the best karaoke show in Thunder Bay. It's 19+, no cover, and that will start at 10.
For more details and a complete listing of what's happening in our city, go to tvshows.com. Thank you for listening and stay tuned to CILU 102.7 FM.
I chose this life. And someday, it's going to get me killed. But not today.
Lorraine Broughton, expert in intelligence collection and hand-to-hand combat.
Agent Gascoigne was killed last night. Did you know him?
Enough to say hello.
He had an atomic bomb of information. Find out who's hunting our operatives and trust no one.
Persons, your contact.
Welcome to Berlin. I'm David.
Don't shoot. I've got your shoe.
Your own personal Jesus.
That was me from the moment my feet touched the ground.
This was never part of the plan.
It was part of mine.
I've lost the target.
For my theme song. What do you know about this woman who's been following me?
You look like you need saving.
So you made contact with the French operative?
Obviously.
The clock is ticking, and everyone you get close to ends up dead.
In 1972, a crack commando unit was sent to prison by a military court for a crime they didn't commit. These men promptly escaped from a maximum security stockade to the Los Angeles underground. Today, still wanted by the government, they survive as soldiers of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can hire the A-Team.
That was the cinematic trailer for Atomic Blonde, followed by the Zombie Kids remix of the majestic Mike Post A-Team theme from the mid-80s. And you're listening to the Cinematic Asylum on CILU 102.7 F and also M. I'm Layman Pascal, and today I'm high on action movies. So what I remember about the A-Team, among other things, inter alia, as they say, I remember that although the bullets were always flying in vast profusion, no one ever got so much as a scratch or a sprained ankle, let alone ventilated and left for dead with lead poisoning, as they say. On the A-Team, they, were constantly shooting machine guns and Uzis, which are great fun for kids to draw, I might add, in every direction. 10-minute bursts of mad machine gun fights with people running in the midst of the field of battle, flying bullets, leaps and dives, chaos, exploding bullet holes ripping up the wood and the ground and the sides of vehicles. And not only does no one ever get killed, no one ever even gets shot. It's just some acrobatic moves and gunfire sound effects, and then the bad guys surrender to hear a cigar-chomping ironic life lecture from the crazier-than-Murdoch Colonel John Hannibal Smith, one of my boyhood heroes, played by the inimitable, the impossible-to-imit, feature film and theatrical legend George Peppard. That was, I think, a legitimately great action show. Sound car chases, engaging fights, watching people train and creatively evade gangs of villainous predators, rapidly upgrading buildings and vehicles into tanks and fortresses, improvisational weapons, great attitude, exciting music. So I loved it as an action show. But you know what really stands out to me is the uncertainty of the significance of the fact that no one ever gets hit by those bullets. I grew up in a time when people were still, maybe they still are, but then they still were, harassed by moralistic worry warts on mainstream media soapboxes who sprung up like mushrooms in your homes and communities on the news, especially the news that reports about the media in which it is embedded. Tonight on the TV news, does watching violent TV make people violent? More on that after this footage of riots. You heard stuff like that all the time. These folks seem to think that exposure to violent movies, comic books, TV, or video games would make kids become more violent. Although they never seem to worry too much about the violence in the Bible or in works of literature, it seemed to be more about the communication medium itself than it was about encountering depictions of violence. Anyway, this idea that you became violent because you saw violence depicted has been repeatedly either downplayed or disproven by studies on behavior and neuropsychology. You probably do become more violent if you see actual violence, but not so much if you see pretend violence. Now, I know this is a complicated topic, but you do periodically hear these studies saying there's surprisingly little correlation between representations and realities, although the people who work in the representation business would love us to be constantly unsure about the relationship between realities and depictions of realities. To paraphrase Nietzsche's theory of tragedy, if horror movies were actually scary, people wouldn't watch them. They'd run away. They're actually experiencing something else, a form of pleasure, which would be hard to notice if you thought people basically had the same reaction to representations of stuff as they do to the actual stuff. You can't drink the word water, and you don't tend to become more violent because you watch pretend violent shows. But that doesn't stop people from hearing constantly, as we have throughout history, that we are all fragile, programmable, tabula rasa things who will be led astray from our values by mere exposure to the depiction of exciting content. We will be radically transformed by what our senses come into contact with. Although, not any of the other things we perceive, apparently just the sex and violence. No one's worried that kids playing maze games are going to start wandering around in mazes, or that Super Mario is going to trigger a wave of plumbers. It's only certain topics that get our pants bunched up. And even though there is some truth, I think, to the idea that we do adapt to the circumstances and pressures of our informational niche, it's all too easy to get carried away with that kind of notion. One study I saw suggested that people's brains are indeed massively affected, injured in our self-esteem by what people think other people are signaling with what we perceive of their actual clothing and makeup in real life, but hardly affected at all by glossy images supposedly being promoted on the covers of magazines. Wait, what's a magazine? Does anyone know what a magazine is? I have a note here to look it up, but I never got around to it. It seems like real life is the area we should be concerned about, and not so much the representations of life or the presentation of fantasies. Those can remind us of upsetting things, but in most cases the actual experience is light years away from having the influence of really upsetting real things on us. And we probably shouldn't be teaching each other and our children to be so fragile and reactive in the face of mere media. That gives it a power that it really doesn't have unless we freak out about it. Nonetheless, I feel like we do thrive or collapse inside ourselves depending on whether or not we get good impressions, healthy perceptions that we assimilate well. But the argument about what constitutes positive perceptions, healthy perceptions, nutritious perceptions, has always been a rather one-sided argument in favor of the loudest people who seem to want some pablum combination of intelligence suppression with the removal of exciting content. The first thing Hitler does is ban modern art and avant-garde art because he fears it will corrupt the minds of impressionable Germans. So that's not a great position to take. Hitler is not generally remembered as a guy who knew the difference between healthy and unhealthy art, or healthy and unhealthy perception in general. Here's what I think is bad content, bad for people's brains, bad for children's behavior and society's morals. I think simplistic, lame, clunky, moralizing, fear-based, easily assimilated, boring, and hollow things are the worst to watch. Bad for our souls, bad for our brains. I'd rather children and adults watched a disgustingly well-filmed documentary about maggots devouring deer corpses than some safe, empty, sanitized, easy-to-see fake reality that a nitwit at a corporation decided to brand as family-friendly in order to manipulate people. Easy listening music is not that easy to listen to. You don't get the healthy perceptions by removing all the perceptions that remind us of gross and dangerous things. You get healthy perceptions by seeing the world as it is, seeing high levels of complexity and craftsmanship, seeing things handled in nuanced, intelligent, good-humored, inspired, wondrous, rich, strange, and naturally beautiful ways. That's good food, in my opinion. For a long time, human beings have put up with, almost proudly, this preposterous notion that the things which most people like most about being alive are the worst and most dangerous things for people to see, and should be especially kept away from children, and shouldn't be discussed openly in public, but perhaps only in the back rooms of the British Museum, where sensible, mustachioed older gentlemen can exercise their privilege of perusal without sending the women, minorities, the poor, and the children into hysterics. And that stuff is almost always stuff like action, adventure, doubt, curiosity, sexuality, comedy, aggression, political criticism, hunting, fleeing, learning, being astonished, bemused, irreverent. Do you know how long it's taken to develop a culture in which it's okay to be irreverent? Thousands and thousands of years. Many sacrifices has it taken to get right here. All these things I just mentioned that tend to get suppressed are part and parcel of the flow states that all of us find make life worth living, and yet for a long time, what I might call fake religion, has seriously pushed eating less, loving less, not handling money, not sleeping as much, not using your mind, not being sensitive to your surroundings, don't be curious, don't be inclusive, don't be open, don't be irreverent. The stuff that makes life interesting and healthy was treated like it was the worst stuff in the world. Minimized and demonized. Instead, it was suggested that we concentrate on something else super important, the most important thing of all, which is described to you in terms that are literally impossible and cannot be checked in any way. Nothingness and impossibility are supposedly way better than everything that everyone likes. How weird is that? And I'm pretty sure it's not what the Buddha was trying to say. Although these flow state enemies and excitement squelchers, these anti-inspirationists, believe that they are a moderate, sensible, centrist majority, they always have suppression in their general action toward the things that provide life nourishment and growth to the civilization in which they live. They're kind of like a cancer. So when these people say shows are too violent, it's pretty much laughable. They don't have the moral integrity leg to stand on that they think they do. But that doesn't mean we don't see content that in a very healthy, organic way makes us cringe and not want to watch anymore. That doesn't mean there isn't something important to be understood about how we take in perceptions of things like violence, sexuality, food, politics, war, education, employment, health, conversation, bodies. Something important about how perceiving things makes a real difference. So what is this difference in the A-Team? Because, by the way, we're doing action movies today. This is technically totally all about action movies. So I think about the A-Team as an action show in which nobody ever gets shot and everybody's always getting shot at. What do you think? Is that good or bad? From the point of view of the moral impact of what we perceive, do you think it's better for kids to not see the horrific, horrifying, sometimes even traumatizing, realistic evidence of people inflicting terrible weapons on each other? Or is it better for them to see the reality, to see how awful it is, and not think it's just innocent fun where no one ever gets hurt? I feel like I could go either way on that. It's the kind of question that could be applied across any area of public concern or censorship. And what's better, letting people who are still forming their minds have access to potentially upsetting representations of the real world to which they must really and quickly adapt? Or trying to protect them from confusion, trauma, and unassimilable intensity according to our socially indoctrinated guesses about what's probably bad and upsetting? What's more likely to cause problems? Is it exposure to horrible realities that makes you strong, or is it evading excessive inputs that keeps you safe? Here's the John Witt medley from Le Castlevania.
Thank you.
Well, the John Wick medley and then a little bit of the opening to the theme song from Steven Soderbergh's Haywire, the main title theme composed by David Holmes. I thought that movie had some excellent movie fight scenes, distinguished perhaps from mediocre scenes of excellent actual fights. John Wick was regarded by many as a resurgence of the authentic action movie. I enjoyed the first one, except for the last few minutes. I had to turn off the sequel. I haven't seen the third one, but it was a very pure, very good movie action movie. I never thought of myself as an action fan. Of course, I did love James Bond movies as a kid. I liked to see somebody on top of a train, dodging a blow, diving through windows, scurrying up a rope, running from a predator, or chasing down some prey. That all seems pretty basic, natural, exciting things that probably every child enjoys at some times. I did not, though, go around focusing on action movies. They didn't seem that interesting as a genre to me. So when I got back into watching them in my 30s, I noticed that something interesting had happened in the intervening time since I was a kid. Action movies had oddly gotten less engaging, specifically in their action scenes. Weird. Not all of them, but a great number of them, especially the ones that seemed to have the most people and money behind them. In my view, there'd been a combination of three pernicious factors at work. Pernicious factor one was a shift, partly cultivated by the Bourne films, of showing action scenes as if they were the chemical experience of adrenaline and confusion. Just jumping around, confusing the eye, switching angles, going too fast to track, and getting an overall feeling of stress and motion, rather than watching the actual action play out in a reality that your mind can track, and that therefore your emotions can get quasi-physiologically plugged into. So the first problem was the Bourne style. The second was the rise of CGI. The problem with CGI is that you want to pay for it. Well, you think you can pull things off more effectively and more cheaply doing it once you're into doing it, and you have no limits to your imagination if you just animate everything on the computer, and the result is kind of oddly weighted or weightless action scenarios with too many moving parts to track in all directions. Nothing human, nothing physiological about the action. It makes you merely a spectator of a spectacle of pixels. And so this is what it came to. It's so frequently used, especially in larger budget films, that humans looking for human action tend to tune out during those scenes, but studios often don't notice that tune out because of the third pernicious factor, which is faulty feedback from audiences. Studios had gotten into a habit of paying or rewarding with access the journalists who are most likely to buy into the marketing propaganda of the studio for any given film, which involves praising it on its ethical and social grounds and denouncing anyone who critiques it artistically or thematically as being opposed to those social and moral values. Asking people in the wrong way how much they liked an action scene is similarly bad reviewing, bad feedback. You have these movie theaters full of audiences who are wired up to reaction tables where they're supposed to enter real-time feedback about how they respond to the film as it unfolds so the studio can get raw, unmediated, immediate feedback. But the problem is that we're often at our dumbest in the first moment or two. We take a minute to grasp even the context of what's going on. When we sit down in front of a movie trailer for a movie and it says action and shows you an action scene, your brain goes off. It takes you a second to be like, oh, that's an action scene. And if you're asked in that moment, that's the feedback you'll get. You ask the person who stops the commercial and say, how do you think the film looks? And they say, it looks like it's got a lot of action, because they're still in the process of identifying the category and pumping up the chemicals that go with just category identification. That's why you can do hypnosis on people through reactivation of the orienting response, as mentioned in the prologue to Al Gore's book, by the way. He used to hypnotize chickens, and his critique of television media, whereby commercials put you into trance states by constantly requiring you to adapt to a new reality tunnel every few seconds, so that the activation and reactivation of your orienting response overloads your normal processing centers and puts you in a more focused, more willing state. So you get slightly tranced out people who are taking a second to reorient themselves to the content and are not at their most capable of articulating their overall feelings in that moment, and you ask them to give you immediate feedback, and they say, great, it's an action scene, it seems very action-y. And yet when you're sitting in the movie theater and the scene comes on, and after you recognize that it's an action scene, you kind of click out and you notice that everyone else in the theater has also remembered that they're in a movie theater and they're kind of looking around. Everyone's having the experience that the action isn't that engaging because it's too fast or too big. It doesn't track to our eyes. It doesn't reactivate our own bodies. And yet somebody somewhere down the line said, absolutely, that's very actiony. They got bad feedback. A pernicious combination of a new style of action directing, over-reliance on CGI pixelated spectacles, and an increasingly shallow way of getting feedback from the audience of entertainment and art products. It's hard to see how you could get really good action films over time if that's your approach.
Want to miss. One, Chuck Norris faces the ninja.
I'm gonna kill you.
Unholy Masters of Terror in the Octagon. Two.
You weren't supposed to die.
Jennifer O'Neill and Chuck Norris. He's the only one who can stop the killing in A Force of One. See both action hits together. A Force of One and the Octagon. Rated R.
Now playing at a theater near you. Check your newspapers for theaters and showtimes.
CILU is sponsored in part by the students of Lakehead University, our listeners, and our sponsors. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
The Foundry at 242 Red River Road, open 11 a.m. to 2 a.m. Monday to Saturday, featuring folk in Mondays, karaoke Tuesdays, trivia Wednesdays, open stage Thursdays, and live music weekends. Find out more at thefoundrypub.com. The Thunder Bay Symphony Orchestra. Log on to tbso.ca or call 626-TBSO for details on the 2019-2020 season and how to get tickets. The Lakehead University Student Union, promoting action, advocacy, and service by bringing you student centers. Learn more by visiting their office in the tunnels of the student center or by logging on to lusu.ca.
We'll be right back.
That was the Folsom Lake Symphony Orchestra doing their rendition of the Mission Impossible theme. I'm Layman Pascal, slumming it with action films on the Cinematic Asylum on CILU 102.7 FM. Audiences are more clear, I think, now than ever on what they're looking for. They've flocked in droves to Tom Cruise's unexpected reboot of the old Impossible Mission TV show, in large part because of constant information about how Tom Cruise does all those stunts for real himself, taking real risks and demonstrating unexpected authenticity, especially from such a weird dude. That was a huge driver that catapulted those movies to success, to ongoing success. The exact opposite, in a way, of big CGI spectacle. Not that they didn't use CGI every chance they could get away with, but it wasn't what the people liked the most or came to see it for. It's always been the case that people tell us about the need for spectacle, for image, for plot, for character, but we're somehow as likely to watch and enjoy a hippo fighting a gazelle as we are to watch the most expensive movie or the most critically acclaimed action scene. We've always been like this, but now, having seen so many films and made so many choices about films, we're getting more clear and confident about it. We want real stakes and real action seemingness, which isn't just the most amazing visuals combined with jerky, blurry camera movements to stress and confuse us. If your feet aren't twitching during the chase scene, if you're not involuntarily holding your breath when the hero is underwater, if you're not wiggling a little in your seat trying to throw or block kicks, then it's not a good action movie, no matter how much the studio paid for it and how theoretically vast the represented scene on the screen is. The easier it gets to control the optics, the less the optics matter, in a way. I heard once upon a time that aristocrats liked to be pale to show they didn't have to work outside like peasants, and later the wealthier people liked to be tan to show they didn't have to be stuck inside like pale office workers. The leading edge is always the opposite of what's common and easy. The better our razors get, the more beards we start seeing again. The easier it is to airbrush photos, the more ragged tattoos women put on their bodies. And every action movie that has beautiful scenes and lush visual spectacle without appealing to actual action fans is slowly teaching us that we don't really care how good or professional it looks. We want to see something that feels more real, real enough to anchor our fantasy on. Here's The Fighting Man from the Transporter soundtrack.
Fighting's not that. We'll be right back.
That was DJ Pone's tune Fighting Man from Transporter, followed by Scott Adamson's James Cameron's The Original The Terminator soundtrack cover on CILU 102.7 FNM. This is Layman Pascal, and it's important to me, Layman Pascal, that in action movies I or you want to see something where we actually see it and feel it. Action is rooted for me in the neuromuscular system, so it's not just that chemicals pump out of the brain recognizing the category of action and gets a little bit confused, so acts like it's in the thick of things. It's that the mind and the eye are tracking the movements and sending that information to the brain, activating a low-level muscular response in your body as if it might perform actions like that, and getting pleasantly excited, really prepared, actually in an action flow state. That's what it's trying to do. And if you can't track what's going on, if you don't know the spatial layout that's going on, if you don't know where one car is situated compared to the other car, then after a few seconds in the movie theater, you are going to sit back and be the person who notices that everyone else is suddenly sitting back and noticing that they're in a movie theater. Everybody is not engaged by adequate subliminal structural architectural maps of the layout of the action space. They're not following movements that are at the edge of their trackability so that they can fire up their bodies as if they were involved in the interactions between the multiple agents. In our physical imagination, we feel like we can almost pull off certain moves, but there's a threshold beyond which it becomes so utterly fantastical that we disengage our neuromuscular imagination. In that first Daniel Craig James Bond movie, they had this opening fight scene between him and a monkey-like man. He has to chase up a construction site. It's a fantastic action sequence. I'd argue one of the best, because each one of the action stunt movements is something that you in the audience goes, well, I don't know if I could do that, but maybe if I almost could make it, if I was just trained, if I was just in the right situation, if I just had the right mindset, maybe I could pull off that move. And that's the boot up of your neuromuscular system. It's within imagination's physical striking range that someone could leap 8 feet. You think, probably not, but maybe. But when someone jumps 50 feet, your neuromuscular system powers down. It's not needed for this. It knows that this is no longer about bodies and body space, which is where our action feelings come from. Now it's just about shapes moving in front of our eyes. It has no weight anymore. It's close enough. It has to be close enough, a good action sequence, to activate our physical imagination. If it only activates our mental imagination, then we're physically going to tune out for a few minutes, even if we report that we like the action. All action is ultimately about bodies in body space. Action is not a visual tracking of the concept of interacting bodies. It's the tracking and assimilating and responding to potentially real and exaggeratedly legendary action moves. Since time immemorial, children have been learning to operate their own neurological and organismic systems and their relationships morally in the world by taking on the valence of legendary action heroes. Hercules, Achilles, Odysseus, Aladdin, Sinbad, Robin Hood, King Arthur, Luke Skywalker, Neo. These people did semi-magical acts, at least at first, but not fully magical acts. At that point in the films, they lose us. We don't want to talk about gods, we want to talk about demigods when it comes to action. Action is about heroes and demigods. The legendary, not the mythical. That's what situates us at the dynamic moral center of our own model of neurophysiological and perceptual experience. Demigods can do a little more than the average human being, but they can't do anything. They seduce us into the feeling that we can do a little more than we can, which is actually what helps us do what we can. But there's no action if they can do anything. It's one of the reasons that Batman has proven to be more durable and compelling as a hero over time than Superman. Not that people don't love Superman, but they lose touch with him based on the fact that he's grown too powerful. It becomes fantasy rather than action. It falls into an entirely different genre. Now, here's one of the great action battle scenes and one of the great action car chase scenes from movie history.
Thank you.
First, you heard Canada's most prolific film scorer, Howard Shore, with the legendary Helm's Deep theme from the Battle of Helm's Deep in Peter Jackson's The Two Towers, one of the best large-scale battle scenes using CGI in recent memory. And then, from Tarantino's Death Proof, the song Chick Habit by April March, the soundtrack for one of the great, engaging, distressing, exciting car chase battle scenes of all time. Action movies, over time, live or die, I think, on whether or not children spontaneously want to play the imaginative game of the movie. A movie has cultural impact if children embody it in their interactive learning behavior, which we call play. That means they have to feel it is within the imaginative range of their neurochemical and neuromuscular systems to be able to pull those moves off. That's what makes them want to be a character. Exaggerated, of course, but still on the side of the body, the world, and the possible. It's about the edge of possibility. If it's too fast to track, too incredible to think of, impossible to really pull off, too omnidirectional for the brain to make a mental boxing ring or battlefield out of, then it's not going to have the action it needs to reach those depths in the people who need to grow up and carry action films forward. People played cowboys and Indians for years. They played pirates. Once upon a time, they played Star Wars. Those are things that bonded into the physical psychology of children and went on to teach subsequent generations as those children grew to value and understand and produce high-quality action films with high-quality action in them. That's what you need generationally in order for action cinema to thrive and evolve. You don't have that if you produce top-down ideas of what action people should recognize and simply export screenwriters' vague ideas through corporate optics onto audiences that recognize it technically as being in the action category, but don't actually get physically or emotionally engaged. We want to see people enter into high-octane but relaxed entertainment concentration-focused scenes where they have to bring all of their capacities to bear on important, coordinated, really meaningful tasks and engage with another creative, flowing individual and defeat or triumph over that force by tuning into the triumphant life feeling that you could get if you could sustain that level of action flow coordination in yourself in such a way. That's what makes a good action scene for us. It's what our DNA apparently recognizes as useful. Even those action scenes, usually at the end of films, where we see our great fighter broken down, uncertain to some degree, such that we've raised the stakes of engagement, they're facing overwhelming odds or injury now, even then we know the reason that they can come back from that they can pull off a surprising victory despite their weakness, their being down and outness, their injuredness, despite being set back on their heels. The reason that doesn't stop them, the reason their victory seems viscerally realistic, is because we've already engaged with the realistic depiction of the concentration action flow state that we've engaged many times already in the film. We trust their ability to access that state because, and only if, we've repeatedly experienced their action provoking that state in ourselves earlier. Otherwise, the most overwhelming visual and plot events at the end of a show will be barely meaningful. Listen, I've been Layman Pascal talking about action movies on the Cinematic Asylum on CILU 102.7 FM, and here's some more stuff.
So to start, I want to ask a question. What is a perfect action scene?
Leave it to me. I'll get the murder.
This is a perfect action scene. It's the climactic chase scene from Nick Park's short film, The Wrong Trousers. It does everything a good action scene should do. It's exciting, it's surprising, and it tells a story. So what is that story? On a macro level, it's pretty simple. Feathers
McGraw. Two moves you won't want to miss. One, Chuck Norris faces the ninja.
I'm gonna kill you.
Unholy Masters of Terror in the Octagon. Two, Jennifer O'Neill and Chuck Norris. He's the only one who can stop the killing. In a force of one, see both action hits together. A force of one and the Octagon. Rated R.
Now playing at a theater near you. Check your newspapers for theaters and showtimes.
You got something pretty cool. What should happen between every beat that you've written down is either the word therefore
or butt.
And that's entirely what this scene is. Gromit is trying to catch Feathers, but he uses a gun to open an escape door. Therefore, Gromit diverts the train onto a new track. Wallace lands on the train, but Feathers shoots his car onto a separate track, but he catches up and takes the gun away, but he crashes into a wall. Most of these connected beats, the changes in the character's fortune, are called reversals. Here's Shane Black, maybe the best action screenwriter of all time, explaining reversals.
I think reversals in a story are so important. The example I use is called the haystack game. You're telling a story about it to a friend. Says, well, he fell off the plane. And the friend says, oh my God, that's bad. He says, no, that's good, because he had a parachute. He says, oh, well, that's good. Well, no, that's bad. The parachute didn't open. He says, God, well, that's terrible. No, that's good. It's a reserve shoot. Oh, well, that's good. Oh, that's good.
Are you ready to be entertained? SS Dance and Wiggins Productions present Beauties and Booties 3 Icons, March 6th and 7th, live at the Paramount Theater. Beauties and Booties is back and bigger than ever. Sarah Sorrell and the dancing drag queens and kings of Thunder Bay are excited to bring you on a non-stop adventure to the music of some of the most beloved and supportive figures of the LGBTQ+ community. You'll be on the edge of your seat as these dancing divas bring you more high kicks, drop splits, and hair flips than ever before. Doors open at 7 p.m. for this all-ages show with curtains at 7:30 p.m. Advance tickets are $20 and are available at Paramount Theater Box Office. For more info, follow at Beauties and Booties T-Bay online.
CIOU is sponsored in part by the students of Lakehead University, our listeners, and our sponsors. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
Signal Resources Limited, Thunder Bay's locally owned and operated audio-visual professionals. Contact them about your next multimedia event or installation at 807-475-9341 or at signalresources.com. The Thunder Bay